cataract out and fitting you with really thick lenses, they put a new lens back in there, plastic lens, when they take the cataract out. So you don't have to wear those thick lenses like they used to after they had cataracts removed. Been lots of improvements. Cardiology is a subspecialty of internal medicine. And of course, cardiology, we've learned a lot of things about cardiology now. We've learned how to do cardiac catheterizations and all that sort of thing. And so there's a lot of new specialties, and the specialties that were there do a lot of new things. Family practice is now a specialty, and that board of family practice was developed while I was in practice.
Okay. What are the differences when you first start out to when you're an established doctor? What are those first years like?
Well, when you first start out, I think you're a little less sure of yourself, a little less confident. You come out of your residency not knowing a lot about medications, not understanding a lot of things you're going to run into with patients as you practice. And the first few years, I think you're a little bit uncomfortable, always wondering and worrying about whether you're doing what your patients want and making them satisfied with the way you treat them. But as time goes by, you probably become a little more skillful, or maybe you just think you are at talking with people and understanding what their needs and wants are, and you develop a little more confidence. You get your practice established and you get a good reputation, and then you don't worry so much about whether you're going to be a success or not. And it gets a little more comfortable as you go. Except the things that have made us uncomfortable now are the lawsuits, and then they've developed all these HMOs and the Medicare law came into being while I was in practice, and so now we're, and then the Medicaid law came along, so now that most of my patients are not paying their bills when they come to my office, I'm at the mercy of the third party payers as to what my income is. They pay what they want for what they want to pay for, and however much they want to pay for it, they decide. And I don't have a lot to say about that anymore.
So what was the insurance like when you first started out?
There was practically no health insurance around except Blue Cross Blue Shield. And there wasn't a whole lot of restrictions on it, but hospital costs were very high. We didn't have MRIs, and we didn't have CAT scanners, we didn't have cardiac catheterization, and we didn't have these $50,000 coronary bypass operations, and we weren't doing organ transplants. It was these terrible big money items that supposedly are so beneficial to people, just were not around then. So the insurance wasn't as restrictive now. Now that we've got all these very expensive technological things, it's costing business that pay health insurance for their workers a lot of money for their insurance. So they're a lot more careful now where the money's spent. And they're a lot more restrictive now. And patients to be in the hospital have to meet certain criteria. They can only stay so long or until they're able to leave, and there are certain criteria we have to go by there. There are certain things I can do in my office and that they'll pay for, and certain things they won't pay for. So we have to sort of tailor our medical practice around what insurances will allow.
What's an MRI?
A magnetic resonance imager. It's a machine where they put you in a very powerful magnetic field, and all of your molecules and atoms and cells polarize themselves along the lines of force in that very strong magnetic field. And then when they turn it off, they can by X-ray, or I think it's by X-ray. We don't have one, so I'm not real familiar with it. But anyway, depending on how rapidly these tissue molecules resume their normal polarity, they can diagnose, multiple sclerosis can be diagnosed with MRI, for instance. Some cases, certain cancers can be diagnosed, some bone problems and that sort of thing. It's a step beyond the CAT scanner.
X-rays were they around when you first?
Yeah, X-rays were here, but we didn't know a lot about X-ray. When I first started practice, we didn't really realize how dangerous X-rays were. And I've known of cases where doctors would treat eczema on a mother's hands with superficial X-ray therapy. And while they were getting this X-ray therapy, they'd allow the mother to hold her newborn baby in her lap. And of course, this X-ray was very dangerous to the baby and would actually burn their skin. And they would grow up with horrible scars all over their body from that X-ray therapy. And forever afterwards would periodically develop cancers in that X-ray burned skin, but at that time they didn't realize that it was a dangerous thing. Now they never use superficial X-ray to treat eczema or warts. When I started practice, they used to treat warts with superficial X-ray, but they don't anymore because it's dangerous. And we use X-ray as sparingly as possible. We've developed means of getting good pictures with very, very little radiation exposure. So we are not afraid to use it if it's needed, but we don't like to use it if it's not needed, and especially in young people.
Okay, financial question. What was it like to be a doctor then? And if, let's say, when you were first starting to be a doctor, an established doctor of the day, mm-hmm. of the late 50s, early 60s, what would be the difference of that doctor and you today?
You're talking about finances,
yeah.
Money? How much money you make? Well, I can't tell you what my annual income would have been when I first started practicing. Probably in the neighborhood of maybe $20,000.
Was that a lot for the day?
Well, it was quite a bit. They were hiring people into General Motors then for $2.61 an hour, I believe. So the automobile workers, who were, you know, among the better income people, were considerably below that. But it seems to me that the second full year I was in practice, I believe my income was $20,000. That increased as I went along for a few years. And since 1973, my take-home pay, the money that I can take home from here, has steadily decreased. The dollars have decreased since 1973. That's now 17 years. The gross that I take in has remained fairly steady over those same years. My price per office call has increased some since then. But my expenses have increased since then. And we've had the HMOs, we've had the Medicaid program and the Medicare program, which don't pay you your charges. Medicaid pays about half. Medicare pays maybe three quarters. They claim they pay 80%. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Some of the HMOs are about like Medicaid. Some of them are pretty good. They pay reasonably near your charges. But expenses have continued to go up. And when I was able to take home that $20,000, my expenses in this office were then 39% of what I took in. Now my expenses are 69.9% or something like that of what I take in. It goes for expenses. And so the money that I can take out of here has just steadily gone downward for the last 17 years. And I would be better off financially if I were working at General Motors right now, 40 hours a week, with an occasional Saturday for overtime. I would make more money. I would take home more money than I do right now. And that's not going to encourage people to go into family practice because they won't be able to make it. I came here to Chesaning $80,000 in debt. And I'd been here 6 years when my first daughter graduated and started going to college, and I've had somebody in college ever since, until a year ago. So I haven't laid up very many millions while I've been here. But I'm still buying groceries.
So do you think that scares?
Oh, I'm sure it does. It bothers people, and it's going to keep them out of family practice. There's going to be a huge shortage of family practitioners in the very near future if they don't do something about it. You see, if I were to restore my buying power, my purchasing power, where it was in 1973, I would have to be charging $50 for an office call instead of $25. And that would restore it to where it was, right as conditions are right now.
So you're saying you'd have to double?
I'd have to double what I charge people. But you see, I charge $25. My expenses are 69% of what I take in. I get paid half that. $25 for a Medicaid patient. So every time I see a Medicaid patient, you see, I'm losing money. I'm losing about 19% of $25 every time I see a Medicaid patient. And I see a lot of Medicaid. There's a lot of them around. But Medicaid just doesn't pay adequately, and you know, you wouldn't get any other business. You wouldn't find a grocery store that would sell Medicaid people groceries for 19% less than they have to pay for them themselves. They wouldn't stay in business. But that's what I'm doing here with Medicaid people. You know, no other business would or could do that. You know, the reason I can do it, I guess, is that just putting in extra time to make enough to do it. But I'd be better off financially if I didn't see Medicaid. I'd be better off if I didn't see PHP, which is an HMO in Lansing, if I didn't see their patient, because they pay $17, or Medicaid pays about $12. I'd be a lot better off if I didn't see him. I wouldn't have to work as many hours. I wouldn't have to hire as much help. But I'd be better off financially. I'd make more money.
lost my question again. So if the general practitioner, the ratio of them per specialist, let's say, goes down considerably, where are the people going to go? They can't go to a specialist.
Well, a lot of people do go to a specialist, but you know, the specialist does what the specialist does. You go to a surgeon, he's going to worry about surgical things, and that's all. You go to an ophthalmologist, he's going to take care of your eyes, and that's all. There's been a whole study done by Dr. Shao, and I believe he's from Harvard, and he has come up with recommendations for what they call a resource-based relative value fee schedule, where they've taken into consideration the resources you use, your office expenses, the time you spend, and what you put into seeing a patient. And he has come up with recommendations that family practitioners, internists, pediatricians, fees be increased by 75%, 77% actually, and that some of the surgical subspecialties like cardiac surgeons, chest surgeons, orthopedic surgeons, ophthalmologists, and so forth be decreased by a certain percentage, you know, to bring their fees down. You see, an ophthalmologist, for instance, will do a cataract extraction and lens implant. It's a 20 to 30 minute operation with no risk of life at all, and they get $2,500 for it. And they may do 10 of those in one day. Well, that's $25,000. I've never had a month ever in my practice when I grossed $25,000. And an ophthalmologist can do that every day, and there are lots of them that are doing it every day. But you see, and they're trying to do something about that, because if they don't, they're going to lose the people who think and take care of people, like the internists, the pediatricians, and the general practitioners. And all they're going to have left is these people that are procedure-oriented, who, you know, and that's what the big money is paid for now, is procedures, surgical procedures. And it shouldn't be that way, because there's a lot more to medicine than just operating. So maybe if that resource-based relative values fee schedule does come to be a reality, then maybe we will be making a decent income so that people can afford to go into family practice. Right now, 60% of the people coming out of training in the what they call the cognitive specialties, family practice, internal medicine, pediatrics, are going into salaried positions. They're not going out into practice in the country like I'm doing here. They're going to work for hospitals, insurance companies, anywhere they can get a salaried position where they know they've got a guaranteed income.
But was that unheard of when you first started?
Pretty much. There were very few doctors that worked at salaried positions. They, you know, they practiced and fee for service medicine, and it was a lot less costly to people, although people had to pay their bill that way. Now they're getting away from fee for service medicine, and they're paying us either on capitation or something of that nature, so that. But it still is a costly thing.
Okay, hospitals from when you first started, what were they like when you, or has that really not changed?
Well, it's changed because of the technology. You see, we had X-ray, and we had a laboratory. But probably 90% of the blood tests we can do now were not available when I started practice. A lot of the X-ray procedures that we can do now were not available in our X-ray department. And we didn't have any of this nuclear capability where we can do like the gamma camera on the thyroid that I told you. We can do scans of the liver, the spleen. We can do scans to tell where you're bleeding in your GI tract, if you're bleeding now, by putting a radioactive isotope in your bloodstream, and we can take a picture and see where it's leaking out of the vascular system and tell if you're bleeding from a Meckel's diverticulum or a peptic ulcer.
We were talking about hospitals.
So we've got all this technology now. We've got a CT scanner, CT or CAT scanners. They used to call them, stands for computerized axial tomography. That's why they call them CAT scanners. Where we can diagnose much smaller tumors, like we can see brain tumors when they're half a centimeter in diameter now, where we used to not even be able to see them with X-ray, because you don't see things like that with X-ray. When it got big enough to cause symptoms, why, we would do all sorts of things like angiography. We would inject contrast media in the blood system, and then we would see that go up through the arteries into the brain. And if we saw a place where that went around something there that wasn't supposed to be there, we'd assume, you know, that's a brain tumor. Well, now with the CAT scanner, we can see a tumor half a centimeter in diameter. So we can find them sooner. People that get bumped on the head and have intracranial bleeding, subdural hematomas, we used to have to diagnose those by signs and symptoms. You know, they would develop what we call pronator drift, where if you have them close their eyes, hold their hands up, well, they might not hold this one up if they had bleeding over here. That hand would keep falling down even though they thought it was still up there. And various other signs that we'd go by. And then you would assume they had a subdural. The neurosurgeon would operate on them, and maybe he'd find it, maybe he wouldn't. Now, with a CAT scan, you can see that bleeding. Somebody bumps their head, comes to the emergency room, they get a CAT scan right off the bat. And you can tell whether they've got any intracranial bleeding or not, so you don't. We used to put them in the hospital and watch them for a couple of days. Now you don't have to do that. You can look at that, and if they're okay, send them home.
Okay.
So things have changed a lot. The personnel has changed. We used to have orderlies to do the heavy work. Now we don't have orderlies. We have nurse technicians. And, of course, they pay hospital people a lot better than they used to now. So it makes hospitals a lot more costly than they used to be.
Okay, I know. Today, if I got in a car accident, I could be rushed to the emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
At any hour.
Right.
What about in 1957, if I was in an accident?
Well, in 1957, we didn't have anybody on duty in the emergency room 24 hours. We always had doctors on call. We had a surgeon on surgical call, and we had either an internist or a general practitioner on medical call for people who had heart attacks and medical problems. So if you went in there was always a nurse. She was on duty there 24 hours a day in the emergency room, and she would take care of the patient until you got there. She would call the doctor on call, or if they had their own doctor, she would call that doctor. In other words, if a patient of mine went in there in the middle of the night, they would call me. If a patient went in that had no doctor, then they would call the doctor on call for whatever problem he had, whether it was surgical or medical. But now, and sometimes we'd go in if it looked necessary. Sometimes she'd call and say, so-and-so's here with an acute tonsillitis. And rather than get up in the middle of the night and go in and see him, you'd say, well, is he allergic to penicillin? She'd say, no, we'll give him a shot of bicillin, you know. And that's the way we practiced then. It's kind of dangerous to give a shot of bicillin because they could react to it and die, you know. But we did it because otherwise we'd be back and forth, you know, 6, 7, 8, 10 times a night, and you'd never get any sleep. But now emergency rooms, for the most part, and hours included, are staffed by doctors 24 hours a day.
When you were first when you were talking about medical school, you were saying that there were just a few women. How about male nurses at that time? Or was that unheard of?
A male nurse, no, they were not unheard of, but they were very rare. When I was just a boy, I can remember an uncle of mine who was a male nurse, and he worked at a mental hospital in Pontiac. But he was about the only male nurse I ever heard of until several years after I was in practice, and then all of a sudden we started to see male nurses.
So did male nurses and women doctors just come about in the same way, pretty much?
Pretty much, yeah. In the last several years, they've gotten to be real common.
And how has residency changed?
Residency has changed in two ways. There's more to learn. There's more technology that we've been talking about. And you can do more specific things for people. The other way it's changed, though, is that residents are now paid. When I got out, I got like $2 a day or something like that when I was an intern and a resident. But and a lot of residencies, you even had to pay to get into them. Most of them, though, you just went there and put in your time. They didn't pay you or anything. When I graduated, Sparrow Hospital in Lansing was offering $10,000 a year for interns. And we stayed away from Sparrow Hospital because we thought they were just hiring bodies to work, you know, and they weren't going to teach you anything. Actually, they had a real good program, and they were ahead of their time, but we were advised to steer clear of Sparrow. They just wanted you to work, and that's all. Now a resident will start out for somewhere in the neighborhood of $15,000 to $18,000 and gradually work his way up, and by the time he's finishing his third year residency, he'll probably be $25,000 to $30,000 income.
Well, thanks.
That's all you need to know.
If I need more, I'll give you a call or something.